This is the Cyber Union Talk Show for Monday, May 7th, 2012. Gimme Net Freedoms!
Hello and welcome to Cyber Unions. I'm Wilton in Glasgow, Scotland. And with me is Stephen.
Yes, me. And you've gotten me up so early in the morning, Walton. Nobody gets me up this early unless they make me breakfast. Where is it? I want my breakfast. How are you doing in midday Scotland?
Yeah, it's after midday. It's after 2 o'clock recording. So a little bit of sunshine, which is welcome. And for listeners, it's Bank Holiday Monday. So I hope that if you're in the UK, you're enjoying a well-deserved day of rest, and you're still in bed and not working.
That's a hopeful sign. I don't think the same holiday exists here, because that was last Monday, the actual May 1st, which is when you're supposed to take the day off. Though this is my first time of ever being in a country where the day is an actual holiday. So it's actually interesting, I have to say, because the May 1st marches here were huge. And I got one hell of a tan.
Well done.
Yeah, but like the police were escorting every single march. There must have been about 10 or 15 different marches all going to the Zocalo, which is like the center of the city. It was actually really cool to see, honestly. Granted that most of the unions here are pretty damn corrupt, and they put corruption on a whole new scale where you kind of want the mafia to be involved. But other than that, like in the States, I was reading that there was a lot of Occupy, a lot of the radical groups and the immigration groups did a really good show of support and solidarity out there. Chicago seemed to have had a good article written on it, which we'll put a link in the show notes. That was coming from, I think it's Stritz, I can't pronounce the IRC name, but Matt Johnson in our IRC had sent a link about an article covering May Day in Chicago and the differences this year in comparison to last year. Of course, last year was also when Osama bin Laden was killed, which really kind of killed the May 1st feel. No pun intended on that one. It was really good. It was really cool to see an article being written about it. But I think, as Matt had suggested in the IRC, they give a little bit more credence to our ability to understand socialism and the actual consciousness within the labor movement. But it was a good article, so we'll put a link in the show notes for it. How are things in the UK?
Things are interesting across Europe. May Day wasn't huge here the way it sounds like it was in Mexico. But there's certainly some consciousness about it. I guess the big news here is that we had local government elections. So for local authorities, local councils across England, Wales, and Scotland. And mostly the news is fairly good. The Conservative Party, the Tories, vote was decimated. They did really badly. The Liberal Democrats, who are the party that went into coalition with the Tories and essentially sold out, did even worse. Labour did pretty well. The Greens did a lot better than usual. The Scottish National Party did pretty well. And the fascists were completely wiped out.
Generally,
big shift to the left. The one disappointment is that the blonde buffoon Boris Johnson remains mayor of London with a reduced lead. But unfortunately, people chose to vote for vacuous celebrity nonsense over any kind of substance, which is disappointing. But generally, an interesting result and an interesting election period in Europe generally, because there's the election in France, which might see the return of Hollande, which would be, I guess, a shift to the left in France as well. And also next week, I think, significant elections in Greece. And, seeing that Europe is the last holdout of any remnant of the social democratic post-war settlement, and that Greece is the domino in the final neoliberal assault on social democracy, what happens in Greece is crucial, because if Greece falls, then the next domino is Spain and Portugal and Italy, and then the last kind of last holdout of social democracy is destroyed, and we're all in the same neoliberal wonderland that you've enjoyed for most of your life, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a great experience, I must say. That sucks. And let's hope it doesn't come to that, but let's also hope that there's a big revolution at some point soon. Please. We need it desperately. And not, you know, anyhow. But that sounds good. In fact, I think the elections is something that we'll have to cover next week and just try to give a recap, because I know France is having elections this weekend that is going to be... It seems like that the Socialist Party is likely to take out Sarkozy, which is anything is better than Sarkozy. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes as well. And I mean, elections are here in Mexico coming up in July, and it's kind of ridiculous. But we should definitely talk about that next week.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm stretching. It's still morning. I just wanted to share one other thing, just on a little brief little tech thing before we get into our interview, which is a really extensive interview that I think is really good. Just this morning, I was reading an article about OpenStreetMaps, which apparently Apple, which if nobody really knows, I think we may have said this a number of times, but Steve Jobs and Apple were the first violators of the GPL, the free software license. They had been using and switched from Google Maps to OpenStreetMaps. But OpenStreetMaps has a very strict thing of, if you use it, which you're free to do, please give credit. And initially, Apple didn't give credit, but through this article, we'll put a link in the show notes for, surprisingly, an Apple iOS developer may be the reason that Apple actually ended up giving credit for the OpenStreetMaps. Mm-hmm. So now on the application, I think it's on their iPhone or iPad. I can't remember which one it is specifically. I don't have either, so it is irrelevant to me. But it is cool to see that Apple is giving credit to OpenStreetMaps, which in turn gives OpenStreetMaps credibility, which is actually a very good tool to use instead of Google Maps if you don't want to be tracked. So, but I also found out in addition to that in DuckDuckGo, mm-hmm. if you do the Bang OSM, as in OpenStreetMaps, it'll do a search on OpenStreetMaps. That was bothering me, because if you just did Bang Maps, it would go to Google Maps. And I wanted to use OpenStreetMaps and just guessed, and it worked. So Bang OSM does OpenStreetMaps on DuckDuckGo.
I'm really liking DuckDuckGo a lot more the more I use it.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
It's a phenomenal searchability. It seems so much more intuitive in a lot of ways too. Even though there are some things you have to learn about it, it just after a while you're like, wait, I don't have to deal with all this Google ad crap. This is great. So, it is a good thing. Without further ado, Walton, I think we should actually jump into this interview. It is quite extensive, so.
Yeah, and I'm excited about it, because Smarty McCarthy is really, really interesting. I've heard a lot about him, read a lot of about his stuff, heard a lot about INI, the Icelandic Modern Media Institute, and now the International Modern Media Institute. And it's a worthwhile and fascinating project, and I think it's going to be fantastic. So here we go.
Enjoy. So joining us today on Cyber Unions is Smarty McCarthy from the IMMI, which thank you for joining us, Smarty.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, what does the IMMI stand for?
Well, it used to stand for Icelandic Modern Media Initiative when we started the project, but now we've founded an institute around it to kind of keep the original IMMI project, as we call it, and a few other projects under one hat. So that's called the International Modern Media Institute. We thought we were being very clever when we came up with that, but really it's just confusing.
IMMI is how I pronounce
it.
So.
Yep.
So, Smarty, can you tell me, tell us a bit about what IMMI does? What is the project about? What are you trying to do? Why did you start it?
Well, we started it as a kind of idea of taking the best laws from around the world and packaging them up into this kind of shield or safe haven thing, with the idea of making Iceland into the best country in the world to host information. Now, really, we don't really want to stop at that. Using Iceland as a kind of test bed is quite good, because it's a small country with a very strong democracy and you know, it's nimble, it's quick, it can take sensible decisions very quickly. But ultimately what we want to do is just raise the bar on free speech and privacy rights and access to information and communications, mm-hmm. just raise the bar high enough that we pull it up globally and kind of be able to lobby different countries to adopt similar laws.
So it's a best practice standard that you're trying to develop and set, and hoping that activists in other countries will use that example to push for similar laws in their own countries.
Yes, exactly. We want to kind of break the mold that, since I got involved with internet activism or information activism almost 10 years ago, we've always been on the defensive, and, you know, the internet has always been taking hits. But mm-hmm. one of the things that we're trying to do with this is kind of reverse that trend a little bit and start being proactive in saying, okay, this is the kind of legislation that the internet wants to protect itself against people who want to damage the internet and damage human rights and free speech. And once you kind of put that kind of value statement forward, and it's very mm-hmm. easy to tie it up with commercial interests and human rights arguments and actually just any argument is easily won with this kind of rhetoric. So that's basically the idea. Start entering the conversation as an attack vector as opposed to a defensive strategy.
That's very interesting. Now exactly, I guess, I being from the U.S., we supposedly have great free speech laws, which is a whole other thing when it comes to practice.
The United States Constitution says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, etc. But that doesn't really stop, city councils, for instance. So one of the things we've been seeing quite a lot in relation to the Occupy movement is that free speech rights are quite easily trodden down when it's municipal authorities working together.
Yeah, that's clearly happening. Definitely, as I was just reading a case that a couple of legislators and journalists in the city of New York are actually suing the police department for violating First Amendment laws. But there are ways that the cities are able to get around it and put regulations and violations and different things. It's quite disturbing in a lot of ways. But how does the IMMI how does it go further in this process?
Well, so the first thing to understand is that all of the free speech protections that are ingrained in constitutions worldwide more or less just came out of the kind of philosophical movement at the end of the 17th century. And the idea there was always just, let's just allow free speech. It was very simple. Mm-hmm. And protect it. But there wasn't any nuance to that, and we're 200 years down the line, and two world wars, an industrial revolution, and an information revolution later, and the complexity of human civilizations has just increased so amazingly that it's the types of free speech protections that people dreamt up 300 years ago or 200 years ago just don't really manage to cover it anymore. So one of the ways we're trying to do this is just by adding a bit of nuance. We're looking mm-hmm. looking around at the different types of situations that come up, and once we've identified an actual problem, then we try to abstract it a bit and see if the problem has any other kind of angles to it. And once we've figured that out, then we can start saying, okay, this is a law that we need to build. So one aspect of that is, for instance, libel tourism. Libel tourism is this kind of weird situation where in most countries, when you sue somebody for libel, you need to prove that they were libeling you. And in sensible countries, them having told the truth is actually a valid defense. But in the UK, the truth is not necessarily a defense, and what's more, the person who is accused of libel has the burden of proof. So suddenly, instead of the accuser having to shoulder that burden, the accused has to do it, and that really makes things a lot more complicated. It means that accusers can tie people up in court for, you know, virtually indefinitely. It becomes just a question of how much money each party is willing to throw at the problem. And this is really bad. So libel tourism is this kind of weird situation that lots of people take their libel cases to England rather than dealing with them in whichever country would be most appropriate. And finding ways of stopping that is very important. New York actually came up with a way of doing that a couple of years ago, which is basically to say, we're not going to respect any court verdict which comes from a country that doesn't have First Amendment-style protections for free speech. And the way we are going to try and do it here, and actually this is kind of one of the things that can be, you know, ticked off our list, is Iceland's party to something called the Lugano Treaty. And Article 34 of the Lugano Treaty more or less says that that a court in one country, one member or signatory state of this treaty, can refuse to honour a court verdict from another state if it violates the general rule of law. So, you know, it's a kind of a neat little kind of lawyerish hack that allows us to just say, you know, if a court verdict comes from England, and, well, then we won't necessarily accept that court verdict here, and you'd have to retry the case in order to have it enforced, which is exactly what we need.
So I guess the IMMI passed in Iceland recently, right?
Not exactly. So what happened was, back in 2010, we wrote a parliamentary resolution proposal. And that basically means it's it turned out to be a parliamentary resolution, so it was accepted unanimously in June of that year. And what a resolution is, it's just kind of Parliament, the Legislative Assembly, saying to the Executive, we want you to do this. And the Executive now has to go and work through and figure out all these different laws. And there's about 14 different laws that need to be changed. So this is kind of, you know, that was the start of what's going to be a long process. It's going to take 2 or 3 years more. And, you know, it starts off really, really slowly. So for the first 2 years, we didn't really have anything to say except, you know, we're working on it. Now, recently, we put out kind of our first status report, which kind of goes through, you know, okay, we've gotten source protection through, we've gotten this libel tourism thing more or less put a lid on it. We've got computer emergency response team in the works. We've got certain changes to information rights almost out of the parliament. You know, there's various things, but it's kind of just, it's taking a long time. We haven't even started touching on the issue of whistleblower protection because it's just a really big thing.
Smurdy, just as an aside, one of the things that occurs to me is that all of this has only become possible due to crisis. The global financial crisis, as we know, had a devastating effect on Iceland, which also led to a political crisis. And if I remember correctly, there was a massive change politically, where some of the smaller parties became more prominent. And I think it's Birgitte Jonsdottir, is that correct? Who was a member of your parliament who was able to put a lot of this through. And that's personally interesting to me, because one of the things we talk about on the show at the moment is the role of crisis in facilitating change, and how trade unionists and other activists can use the crises that we face around the world to leverage situations which would have seemed intractable during the economic boom a few years ago. So would you say that it's correct? It's only due to a breakdown of some of the old certainties that you've been able to bring this initiative forward?
Yeah, well, certainly Iceland went through a kind of rough patch of economic woes starting in 2008, and that kind of opened up a lot of opportunities. You know, somebody said you shouldn't waste a crisis.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it's only possible because of that. You know, this kind of thing, you know, the crisis definitely led to a kind of line of thought which allowed us to start thinking about these kind of things. But I'm not sure that that in a kind of non-crisis situation it would have been entirely impossible to do it. But the crisis certainly helped, and in part because it got kind of these self-described radicals into the parliament. You know, people like Birgitta, who you know want to push for systemic change and want to alter the way politics is done. So you know, having her there absolutely changed. You know, that probably made it possible more than a lot of other things, because she kind of jumped onto this idea very early on when we were talking about it, and kind of carried it through and did all of the negotiations within the parliament that that made it the proposal go through. But the other thing is, you know, when you have a country that's gone through a crisis, people start to be a bit more open to weirder alternatives. We had been kind of, banking super state on a micro nation scale for several years up until 2008, and you know, when the banking sector disappeared suddenly, what we had left was fish and aluminum. And people, you know,
and cheap energy,
yeah,
cheap green energy,
cheap energy, sure, but we can't really export that, and you know, it's not really the only way we can export it today is through importing bauxite and exporting aluminum. You know, that's a really energy intensive process, but it's a really dirty process that a lot of the people in Iceland just don't really want. So you know, at the same time, we have a massively educated population. That's used to very, very low unemployment levels, and you know, people who really genuinely want to be hardworking, and the crisis moved the unemployment level from 1% up to 9%, and just didn't really, you know, people were left kind of wanting to see something else come in. Now, what we're proposing, you know, frankly, you know, with data centers and so on. Data centers really don't hire that many people. You know, that's not really their value. But having data centers in good environments with cheap energy and good legal protections and good connectivity to the outside world is kind of a prerequisite if you're going to start doing a heavily ICT-based or you know, communications or information technology-based economy. And today, you know, there are some very big information technology companies here, like CCP, for instance, which is, you know, a very large computer game company. But they have to run all of their servers from London because the latency is just too high. And then there's companies like Opera that that run their download system from here because they don't really care about latency. So, you know, within all this kind of realm of services that you can provide online, you know, building the infrastructure and making that available will actually help for about 2/3 of all of the different scenarios that can come up. And then you just need well-educated people to jump in and make, you know.
So it's also an opportunity for Iceland to develop a new sector to replace the hole left by the collapse of finance.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully a more diversified, you know, I mean, putting all your eggs in one basket is a you know, not very clever, and hopefully people here have learned that lesson.
So it seems that the political dynamic in Iceland is much healthier in a lot of ways than other countries. And I guess one of the things that I'm wondering, because I imagine it has come up in discussion, is the ACTA and CISPA, which is currently going through Congress in the U.S. right now, what the IMMI's thoughts on it, and how to work. I guess it would be against, but that's my assumption.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we start with ACTA, ACTA has already been ratified, or it's already been signed by the United States. It hasn't been ratified there. And it's a multinational trade agreement. And currently the only thing standing between us and total doom is the European Parliament. And they have an election on it there in June. So what total doom means in this case is an absolute breakdown of intermediary liability limitations, a criminalization of copyright violations, which kind of opens up the door for all sorts of gross violations of free speech by simply just enabling a kind of chilling effect. The chilling effect coming from these companies which are using their intellectual monopoly rights to stifle the propagation of information through the world. And it also has some kind of weird other consequences, like for generic drugs and seeds. The ACTA isn't really just a threat to the internet, it's a threat to a kind of very large portion of human endeavors, right down to agriculture. And the agriculture argument is one that you hardly ever hear anybody talk about, because the farmers just think it's an internet thing, and the internet people don't really understand farming. So, I would love to see, hackers going side by side with farmers and, everybody with pitchforks, but I just don't see it happening. but either way, hopefully ACTA will be stopped, and realistically, even if it gets stopped in Europe, then there's already lots of signatories, Mexico, United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, etc. Morocco is even a member of it for reasons that are entirely beyond my comprehension. But but the question is, what becomes of it if Europe doesn't join? Probably what will happen is that its teeth will be drawn out to a sufficient extent that the rest of the countries never actually ratify it. But hopefully that will happen. But possibly the United States, who are the instigators of ACTA, will just say, okay, let's just carry on with it anyway. I mean, at least we have copyright violations in Mexico, taken care of for the next unforeseeable future. And that would be a real tragedy. One of the things we've seen a lot in recent years, for instance, in the new Kenyan constitution. So Kenya did a constitutional reform a couple of years ago, and it has three different articles providing for intellectual monopolies. So when I say intellectual monopoly, I'm saying I mean what other people call an intellectual property. But it's very strange for a country to have three different articles on intellectual monopoly rights, and this is kind of a global trend that's happening, where it appears that there was some lobbyism from some angle that's managed to get into the Kenyan process, and that's kind of an entry point of kind of wedging their way into East Africa as a whole. Mm-hmm. All these emerging markets are just waiting to be tapped and or controlled by entrenched interests. So,
Smorty, this is it's really really fascinating stuff, and I was quite taken with the way you described the split between the farmers and the internet activists. And I'm wondering what kind of role the labor movement could play in this. We had a discussion before we started recording where you spoke about the industrialization of the internet and where is the digital labor movement? Why are unions not organizing people online? And I'm wondering if there's a way that unions can understand the importance and the implications of these things and maybe help to bridge some of that gap. Do you have any thoughts on the labor movement?
Well, yeah. The problem that the labor movement's kind of been caught up in the last 100 years is that after the 8-hour work week was established and universal suffrage, those were the two big wins. And since then, not really mm-hmm. much has happened. It's kind of gone the same path as a lot of other kind of political ideologies or goal-oriented movements. in the sense that once the goal was reached, then nobody knew what to do anymore. And since then, you know, everybody's just been haggling over the little stuff, the details. One of the reasons I think that's happened is because of a massive centralization of authority within the labor movement, kind of the creation of hierarchies and power structures.
Yeah, I think we agree completely with that.
Yeah. So one of the things that that you know, we're looking at the internet, and this is kind of, you know, where all my analysis comes from, is always looking at the internet and actually looking at the Industrial Revolution, because I think it's a fascinating mistake in human history. the Industrial Revolution kind of promised everybody, you know, less work, more quality of life, better equality, etc. But then it just didn't happen. And it didn't happen because there was this ownership element, this kind of control structure that came from the fact that the machines were really difficult to build, they were expensive to build, and not many people could actually do that. So you have things like in England during the 1811 to 1815, the Luddite movement, which, you know, they're always put forward as kind of this anti-technology, anti-progress kind of group of terrorists. But if you actually read through their writings, you find out that they were not really against the technology as such. They were against the centralization of the control of technology. Although to be fair, the way they put it forward at the time wasn't really all that nuanced. They were kind of a couple of decades too early to get kind of Kropotkinite or Marxist analysis. But, you know, that would have been really helpful. But, you know, looking at the internet today, you see exactly the same thing. You see this kind of trend towards greater centralization where, you know, 2 decades ago, everybody ran their own email server. They communicated over Usenet news groups. They had PBSs, you know, these kind of really decentralized and localized services that were very democratically operated. And now we have Facebook and Twitter and Google. You know, each of these is quite nice in its own right. They have, you know, they've managed to do some really amazing things. But because they're centralized services, instead of being protocols that allow everybody to communicate on the same power level, we have this kind of centralization tendency. And one of the things we can do is just kind of take a step back and move towards this kind of traditionalist approach to the internet and say, wait, let's stop this institutionalization of communications and start building these dispersed mesh networks of anybody who wants to participate. And let's do it by exchanging the institution itself for a language by which we can communicate with each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So taking us back to the labor movement, well, what's happened there? We've seen a super institutionalization, which has led to very few people having lots of control over the way we do things, and there's practically nothing that happened because the entrenched powers in the labor movement just don't have the any incentive to change the status quo. So,
or insight, I think.
You know, yeah, or that. So, okay, let's replace the institutions that are labor movement, labor unions, with a language. You know, let's figure out a way to allow everybody who could be or should be engaged in labor struggle to communicate with each other on a peer-to-peer basis. Once we do that, then we can start talking about, you know, real change of the proportions that we were looking at, you know, around May 1st, a couple of hundred years ago. Well, actually 130-ish years ago, but you get my yes. Meaning, right?
in our last podcast, we actually discussed the history of May 1st and starting in Chicago in 1886, so yeah.
Ah, yes. Hey, Mark.
There we go.
Very good. Yep.
Yeah, so I mean,
That, by the way, is absolutely crucial stuff, because that is the project that we're trying to engage with, is what you've articulated there. So it's very good to hear it all from you. I work for a trade union, so I know all the structural problems with the organization and how there's a lack of insight and understanding of how production has shifted. You know, we're no longer in a Fordist manufacturing environment. We are in a totally different world. The principles are the same. People are still working. We need to organize them, but we have moved into a different space, and we need to approach that space differently. So
absolutely,
It's good to hear all of
well,
that.
Well, actually, I have some writings on the subject that could be useful to you. But let's talk about that.
Another
time. Yeah, yes, certainly. And my experience has been working with the labor unions in the States, and seeing the hierarchical structures of it is just mind blowing and disturbing in so many different ways. I was curious, kind of going a little bit back to the IMMI, because when I was looking through some of the information online, it had specifically mentioned stuff or goals of trying to protect whistleblowers and trying to figure what the idea is behind that and how and then what mechanisms would be in place to protect them in that situation.
Okay, well, so protecting whistleblowers is probably one of the most complicated things I've ever tried to wrap my head around. it's not difficult to understand. It's difficult to plug all the holes. You see, you have different types of whistleblowers. So commercial whistleblowers, political, people from inside state bureaucracies. You have people from civil society. You have individuals who are not really connected in any way to any of that insofar as they're whistleblowing. And then you have the different problems that they can be facing. So this could range from losing their job, so having financial troubles, to violating state secrecy laws or laws which are considered to be anything from national security interests to privacy rights, and then issues regarding psychological health, you know, basically whether people go into PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, after having blown a whistle on something, and then of course physical threats. So needing kind of similar things to witness protection programs or so on, and you know that's without even getting into all of the complexities that come from the different types of agency, the different types of exposure, and the different people who are pissed off at the fact that they just had the whistle blown on them. So you know, it's a very wide spectrum of problems that need to be dealt with. And in going into this, we've been moving towards this by, you know, just we got the source protection through first. We thought that was an easier thing to achieve. And source protection is basically allowing journalists to have legal protection that prevents them from being coerced and actually, in fact, punishes them if they do expose their sources. So that's a very kind of, you know, good start. Then, you know, we're going to be moving towards that for a long time, but effectively, you know, once we have enough pieces in place, we're hoping that the complexity of whistleblower protection will kind of dissolve into nothingness, and we'll have the perfect bill.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So we have a few drafts that we've been throwing around, but you know, it's really it's brutal stuff.
Yeah. No, I can imagine, and I'm thinking in the lines you were talking earlier about Iceland has become kind of a hotbed for a lot of hosting for a lot of different organizations and things like that, and recently, we had come by the news of a server being taken down in New York, and I'm curious, and this is a little bit out there, but if the server was, say, in Iceland, with hypothetically an IMMI fully supported thing in place, what mechanisms would be there to prevent the FBI or foreign governments from forcing or demanding the hand of Iceland to hand information over?
Well, so. FBI has no jurisdiction in Iceland. If they were to find something objectionable in Iceland, they could basically go through the same procedure as the Icelandic police or any other entity in taking the issue to court and requesting an injunction. Now, So there's an understanding that under our constitution that there shall be no prior restraint, meaning that you cannot be punished for publishing something until you've actually published it. That's kind of the first thing. In order to get an injunction, you need to fulfill certain very strict criteria, which are there for a very good reason. So, for instance, if the issue is that there's a server hosting child pornography, then it'll be easy to get an injunction, and that'll be taken down. The second is a kind of more contentious one, is a copyright violation, so violation of intellectual monopoly rights, in which case the court will grant an injunction and it will be taken down. And the third is one which we are slightly worried about, which is a general injunction, a general court order, which isn't really clarified in law. And that's actually one of our projects this summer, is trying to figure out exactly what that statement should be replaced by. So there's a question of, should libelous comments be taken down? Well, we think not. If something is tagged as being libelous, and maybe if there's a court ruling which says that a statement is libelous, then it might be okay to tag it somehow, to put a notice on the web page or whatever, saying this is libelous content, or this content was found to be libelous under this here court case. But generally speaking, we don't want things to be taken down because of court orders, except in these very narrow cases. So, protection of bodily integrity, protection of minors, that kind of thing is good, but by and large, there shouldn't be any takedown orders.
Smoddy, one of the projects that we speak about quite a lot on the show and which we promote to people is Tor. We think it's a useful tool for activists, particularly in countries where there is a lot of state control of the internet. Do you have any links or any relationship with that project?
Not as such. I know most of the people who work for the project. They're really amazingly cool people. And I fully support the project. I use it myself quite a bit. And it kind of comes into the other aspect of all of this, that even though the project I'm working on is very tightly bound into trying to fix the laws, law is just policy at the end of the day, and that's not policy can be broken. Anybody can just decide that policy isn't policy anymore, and that's not good enough. So, without being too much of a technological determinist, I would say, try to get good laws, try to hold good democracy, but at the end of the day, always have your backup plan, and that should be mathematically provable technological methods, such as Tor.
That's absolutely fantastic. Smoddy, this has been really fantastic. We've got listeners, some of them work in software and IT, and others are ordinary trade unionists. What kind of practical application can you suggest? What is the best way that they can engage with your project and with what you're trying to do?
Okay, that's a difficult one. In part, this kind of comes down to just understanding what your threat model is. If you are hosting a dissident website that's likely to be taken down, and you might want to consider moving it to a country with a good jurisdiction, good protections for free speech, like Iceland. Regardless of what your model is, there's always the situation that there's a massive erosion of civil liberties going on worldwide, very much driven by the copyright holders and so on, or at least that's what we're being led to think. The copyright lobby is big and strong, but realistically, the people who want to get kind of old big brother on us, they really welcome this. It's kind of this lineage where a couple of, I think it was last year or maybe the year before, some representative of, I think it was the International Phonogram Industry Organization. They said that during a meeting in Sweden that they really love child pornography because once censorship has been allowed for child pornography, then they can start asking for the censorship to be expanded to cover copyright violation. And, well, hey, once mm-hmm. you've gotten copyright violation dealt with, let's just expand it to cover political speech that's inconvenient to the incumbents or whatever. You know, you start small and kind of chip away at our rights. And, you know, regardless of whether you're a technologist or, you know, a trade unionist or just a human living in a society, you know, mm-hmm. we need these mm-hmm. free speech rights. We need these protections for our right to communicate. And protecting them in your home country, whichever country that is going to be very, very important for the next couple of decades.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Smadi, thank you very much for coming onto the show. This was exceptionally informative, and I know our listeners are going to really enjoy this. And we definitely, as things mm-hmm. progress with the IMMI in the future, we definitely would love to have you back on at some times. But thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been good.
Thank you, Smadi.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.